Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's broadcast, shining the spotlight on Pope Benedict XVI's visit to Auschwitz, and our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. Each year, the 27th of January marks the day recognised by many nations and officially since 2005 by the United Nations as symbolically dedicated to the memory of the victims of the Holocaust. It's a date chosen simply because it was on this day that the inmates of the concentration and extermination camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau, those who still could, walked to freedom. And it's precisely on Auschwitz that I wish to focus my attention today. This too seemed an obvious choice, given that less than a year ago, Pope Benedict XVI became the first German pope to visit this former Nazi concentration camp in Poland, where 1.5 million people died, a vast majority of whom Jews. This visit in the footsteps of his Polish predecessor to the See of Peter is still fresh in our memory, or at least in my memory. Stay tuned then as I begin by setting the mood as I let you listen to the Jewish prayer of mourning we heard on that occasion. Haunting music we heard there in what was just one of the many concentration camps in Poland. There were many, many more, as Pope Benedict stressed himself when he visited there. By the way, the exact date was May the 28th, 2006. But getting back to Auschwitz, geographically right at the heart of Europe, it once housed interns from up to 29 nations. They came from the four corners of this continent. Just to mention a few, Marie Kafka from Prague, Sarah Komkorn from Amsterdam, Petr Eisler from Germany. Names that struck me when I visited to report prior to Pope Benedict's visit in May. I picked out their names written in white paint on suitcases, a jumble of them piled high behind a glass case of the museum. Located within the concentration camp. Petrus had his birth date on it. He was a year old when he reached there. He lived less than a week. These suitcases, I thought, are all that's left to identify the interns there. On second thoughts, that's not really true. It's not all that's left. The SS kept everything, wasted nothing. From the interns' hair, they made textiles. From the ashes that emerged from the crematorium, fertilizer. The list could go on and on and on. Even young, healthy children were not wasted. They were taught a skill so they would eventually serve the Third Reich. But as I discovered, most never even passed that selection, were never even afforded the privilege of working in a labour camp. They were never allowed to have a purplish number branded on their arms. Only ordered to undress, remember the number of the coat hanger they would never again set eyes on. And taken straight to the four huge gas chambers complete with crematoria that could handle 200,000 bodies at a time. Valley of death, an abyss of terror. Two expressions among many used by Pope Benedict to describe this sobering place as he entered the camp on foot last May under overcast skies. Under the minimalist looking wrought iron gate which reads in German Arbeit macht frei, meaning work makes you free. A cynical slogan indeed, when you realise it was through this gate that thousands of prisoners filed daily, heading out of the camp to work as slave labourers for Poland's Nazi German occupiers during World War II. No doubt, it must have been a tough task for a German Pope as he walked past the double row of barbed wire fences, interspersed with ominous watchtowers, down the tree-lined cobble paths flanking the red brick barracks which today house the museum I was talking about earlier, heading to the infamous block number 11. Called by the prison interns the Block of Death, where SS held tribunals, and where still today, for record's sake, a photograph of Hitler is nailed to the wall. And when Pope Benedict reached the smallish yard attached to it, he went to the very place where prisoners were once executed, namely the execution wall. And 30 or so survivors of these former prisons were there to greet him, 61 years after they walked to freedom. People still branded with a number, and certainly haunted by that horrific memory. But you know, there's one person who wasn't there. He died 10 years ago, 50 or so years after he'd been first condemned. A family man, who Saint Maximilian Kolbe offered his life for all those years ago. And it was to Kolbe's cell, number 18, that Pope Benedict went, down the dank stairs to the cells. A row of them still stand in memory of the thousands who starved to death here, or like this saint, died from an injection of carbolic acid. In Latin, Pope Benedict whispered, "Maximilian Kolbe and the holy martyrs pray for us." But when he went by car a little later to the Birkenau part of the Auschwitz complex, where most of the 1.5 million people died simply because most people who came to this extermination camp were the ones who were considered useless to society, he was taken straight to the gas ovens. And it rained, and all the while he prayed there, walking silently alongside the tablets which bear inscriptions in memory of those who died. Inscriptions which speak of human grief, he was later to say, giving us a glimpse of the cynicism of that regime which treated men and women as material objects and failed to see them as persons embodying the image of God. Some inscriptions are pointed reminders. There's one in Hebrew which reads, "The rulers of the Third Reich wanted to crush the entire Jewish people, to cancel it from the register of the peoples of the earth." And when the German Pope spoke, the rain ceased.
Davanti alla innumerevole schiera di coloro che qui hanno sofferto e sono stati messi a morte.
To speak in this place of horror, he said in Italian, this place where unprecedented mass crimes were committed against God and man, is almost impossible. And it is particularly difficult and troubling for a Christian, for a Pope from Germany. In a place like this, words fail. In the end, there can only be dread silence, a silence which is itself a heartfelt cry to God. Why, Lord, did you remain silent? How could you tolerate all this? In silence, then, we bow our heads before the endless line of those who suffered and were put to death here. Yet our silence becomes in turn a plea for forgiveness and reconciliation, a plea to the living God never to let this happen again. Remembering should lead to prayers for the grace of reconciliation, the Pope went on to say. First of all, from God, who alone can open and purify our hearts from the men and women who suffered here. And finally, the grace of reconciliation for all those who at this hour of our history are suffering in new ways from the power of hatred and the violence which hatred spawns. And when Pope Benedict XVI finished speaking, it was no longer raining, and a rainbow stood out against the skyline, against the barbed wire of this place of memory. A rainbow, then, as Pope Benedict XVI left, a place marking a sobering reminder of the frontiers of evil. But when I spoke to another German, a priest who, unlike our German Pope, did not live through those years, who now works at the centre of dialogue and prayer there, dedicating his whole life to that work of reconciliation and peace for future generations, he told me that the final word at Auschwitz belongs not to Hitler but to God. His name is Father Manfred Deselers, and he works at the Centre for Dialogue and Prayer in Auschwitz. My first question to him was, well, let's listen. Can I ask you a very personal question? Why do you work here at Auschwitz?
It's hard to answer it shortly. In my biography, there were times when I touched the issue of Auschwitz. First time it was after finishing high school. I decided to do civil service with an action service of peace in Germany, an organization which is engaged in reconciliation work after World War II. And with them I spent 1.5 years in Israel. And preparing to this time and work in Israel, we also were here in Auschwitz. This was in 1973. Being here for the first time, I was very much moved and touched and, in a sense, shocked about what my people, the German people, has done. And I understood that being normal is not normal, and it means a great responsibility for peace and reconciliation. And later only, several years later, 2 years later, I decided to study theology and become a priest, and the service for reconciliation for me still is one of the main issues.
You said you came here because of the shock you felt. I think what shocked me this morning, I saw Auschwitz for the first time, was the sheer scale of it and the systematic elimination. What struck you?
The scale, and the scale of loss of feeling, of dignity, of person. People were treated as material. They were used as working labor. But they had no dignity, which was respected. Once I talked with a survivor, a Jewish person, and she asked me, "What do you want me to do here?" And I answered, in a sense, "I want to give you back your dignity." And she said to me, "Oh, Manfred, you don't have to give me back my dignity. I did never lose it. You have lost it." Which means, of course, not personally, I lived not in that time, but those who were responsible for what happened here lost the conscience, the faith, the feeling of human dignity.
You spoke about those who were responsible, so you still feel a common guilt all these years later, 61 years have gone by as a German?
All the survivors say me, Manfred, you are not guilty, because I'm born many years later. I don't feel that all the Germans now living are guilty, but someone did what happened, and there is a guilt, and this is connected with the German people. And it's not possible to escape it. But it's changing into responsibility. I have to know what wounds have been caused in other people, in other nations, and they are still wounds. And this, for me, means a responsibility to try to build bridges, new bridges, to enforce existing bridges, which have to be human bridges, bridges from heart to heart, bridges of trust. I cannot be here just as a human person, not being seen as a human person from Germany. And this has a dimension of special responsibility.
You mention the word responsibility all the time. Why do you think Pope Benedict is coming here? Because he has a duty rather than as an act of courage? Why is Pope Benedict, do you think, as a German Pope, coming here?
No, first of all, he comes here as a Pope. He is not representing the German people, he is representing the Catholic Church. But of course it has a meaning that he is German, like it had a meaning that John Paul II was Polish. John Paul II was born here, not far from here. And so when he came here from a very personal feeling of obligation, and also he was had been bishop in this area. Benedict has a totally different background, but in this time of history, he said himself, maybe it's a sign of providence that after the Polish Pope, there's a German Pope. And coming here, he certainly shows that the memory of Auschwitz and the wound of Auschwitz is something important for the Church, at least in this given time of history. And he feels he should come here to pray, to honor the victims, to show the world and his German people and the Church that it is important to remember and important with this memory, do whatever we can for peace and understanding among nations and religions.
How does one pray in a place where so much evil has been perpetrated? I mean, you know, where was God? Where was man as God's creature?
Not with words. With silence and listening. Listening to the voice of this earth, listening to the memories of the victims, and looking for God, searching God. For us Christians, the memory of Jesus on the cross with the cry, my God, why have you abandoned me, is very important. So it helps to believe that those who died here were not abandoned by God. But for me, it's in a sense easy to say, so I was not here in those times. But there are testimonies of those who survived, even of those who died here. Testimonies of people losing their faith and testimonies of people who died with their faith, Christian and Jewish. But for me personally, the main important aspect is the memory or the belief that those who died here were loved by God. They had a dignity which God gave them, and the murderers could not take it in the end. So God was on their side and not on the murderer's side.
So Hitler didn't have the final word?
He did not. And I believe deeply that God has the last word, and God is love.
You've been listening to Father Manfred Deselers, who works at the Center for Dialogue and Prayer in Auschwitz, who I interviewed there back in May. In this place where hatred wiped out that love, Pope Benedict so vividly reminds us to put into practice in his first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, which was published exactly a year ago. And it's the language of this encyclical that we're about to speak about. Forgive me if you wish for something different, but I can't disappoint the Pope's Latinist following. He's too popular for that. He's Father Reginald Foster, so stay tuned, but be warned, watch the change of pace and tone as he speaks to us of the Latin in the encyclical, but also of the Latin of St. Thomas Aquinas, whose feast day falls on Sunday. One of your jobs was to translate Pope Benedict XVI's first encyclical. You translated it from what language? Italian.
Well, it's Italian, but you could see right away that Italian wasn't the original. I wanted to do it from German. The original was German, and you could see it right away. But they said, no, everyone's translating from Italian. So we're stuck with the Italian. But you could see the Italians don't like the Italian. You see? And so anyway, we did it. And it's very short, 46.
So what's it called in Latin?
Deus Caritas Est. God is love, from St. John's first letter.
So why is charity translated into love? Caritas is in Italian.
Charity, I know.
Charity. There's a bit
Well, that's another story. He spends about 40 pages on the difference between eros, you know, like passionate love, and agape, spiritual love, and charity, and dilectio. Goes through all the words. Well, anyway.
Yes, but charity is one thing and love is another. In English, the title is God is Love.
Yes, I know. The Vulgate has caritas.
Caritas. So it's wrong to translate it as God is charity.
Yeah, it doesn't sound right. Hmm. Yeah, it doesn't sound right at all. But, oh, that's the whole thing about love and love this and all that.
So anyway, what did you find hardest? Can I ask you what you found hardest?
Well, you find hardest is this modern. I would say the modern. I don't have nothing against what is modern, but it's this jargon that you have around. Got it? Like love turns someone into a we. You know, love. You know, a love of our friend turns our friend into a, not into us, but into a certain we. Well, how are you supposed to say all this stuff? You know how people are talking today. That love would make a one person out of two. And so love of a friend, for me, turns us into a certain we. Oh, and you go on and on like this where you can't, it's so impossible to translate some of this stuff. They just never thought that way. The Romans just never thought that way. You know? Or how I'm going to miss a little of my own ego, you know. Well, you have to say in Latin, my own person or something like that.
Ego is a Latin word.
Yes, I know, but there's no way to say it. If you say mei, well, that's a piece of me. But to say I'm losing a piece of me is one thing, and I'm losing a piece of my ego is another thing.
It's difficult because they're all concepts.
Yes, and I'm going to say modern. I don't even like the word modern.
But you say it's modern jargon, no?
Yes, I mean, modern talk. Jargon. Everyone's doing this. Theologians do this, you know, little pamphlets, and everyone's talking this way, and it's preachers. It's horrible. And I told the students the other day, we were reading St. Augustine. They were almost even in tears of St. Augustine. It's so beautiful. I said, well, you have nothing to say. Just translate St. Augustine on the pulpit and sit down and shut up.
Modern jargon. How would you say that in Latin, modern jargon? Yeah. Modern jargon is horrible.
Yeah.
Well, horrible
loquela, locutio. Ah, yeah, recensior locutio. Oh, man, eso terribilis, vel horribilis, vel fugienda est.
But yet,
it's like in the newspapers, you know, everyone just talking around and, you know, gee, oh, it's terrible.
Yet you told me on another occasion that Pope Benedict the 16th is extremely aware of the Latin language.
Oh, yeah. And he's used it all his life.
And he's also notoriously fond of people like St. Augustine and St. Bonaventure.
Yes.
And so he has a soft spot, in a sense, for Latin.
There's no question about it.
For Latin. So how do you say Pope Benedict has a soft spot for Latin?
Yeah. No. De lingua latina tenere sentit. That would be nice. De lingua latina tenere sentit. He feels tenderly about the Latin language. That sounds nice. Tenere sentit.
Well, he changed it too, didn't he?
Whoa, yes. I mean, there are words that aren't right and the phrases weren't right.
So how'd you say fine-tuning Pope Benedict's Latin?
Oh, yeah, well, we're just going to say, yeah.
Well, it's not really his Latin.
Perficere.
His encyclical. How'd you say encyclical?
Yeah, literas encyclicas. Tornare, to polish. Perpolire, to polish off. There is a nice one.
The word encyclical is encyclica. What did it mean to Romans, the word encyclical?
Well, it didn't mean anything. This is a church term. Actually, it's a Greek, of course. It's Greek enkyklo, which means in the circuit. So a letter that the emperors had encyclicals too. The letters that the emperors sent in a circuit throughout the empire was an encyclica, that's all.
So it came from the Greek?
Oh, yeah, enkyklo, in the circle.
There were a few Greek words in this encyclical, no, like agape.
Yes. And a few, I forget, koinonia.
How do these words
translate? Well, they're all in the Bible, you see. And so we had to take kind of what the Vulgate gave us.
You use the word agape?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what are you going to say? It's spiritual or, let's say, noble love.
And what's the other word you mentioned?
Diakonia, service. And koinonia was the communion, the community, koinonia. Those are all Greek words in the church, you see.
But you still use those words in Greek. You don't translate them into Latin.
No, I would do. I would put it, I would, you know.
So what's koinonia?
I would say, for example, like communitas or communio. And I'd put a comma and say, in Greek, koinonia,
yeah,
to respect the original text. But I would tell the people, in Latin, you have to say this.
And when it comes to agape?
Well, then it has to be caritas. And eros, of course, has to be amor. See,
it's a difficult word, eros, because it's taken on different connotations
in
modern languages.
Well, he has a long section on that. And he said, if you just leave eros, amor, the way it is, it's not going to do anything. Because he said, eros without charity is nothing. It's just passionate animal love. He says this. You got the idea.
Was there any Roman who wrote about love that way?
Well, not exactly that.
Not obviously history, you know, such as a theological.
Yeah, no, but Ovid, ooh, heaven's sake, Ars Amatoria, art, and Amores, he wrote about love stories. He had all kinds of love stories.
Who's this?
Ovid, Ovidius. One of the most famous men in the world for love poetry.
But they were very immaterial, the Romans, when they spoke about love, weren't they?
Immaterial. Well, yeah, I mean, they didn't. Well, although they had noble sentiments. When you're reading Seneca in class, you just can't believe it. And that's why I said during the Middle Ages, a lot of people thought that Seneca had been inspired by Christians because he has such noble things. Virtue is this, and without an adversary, virtue languishes. And God, and ooh, he has a whole thing about divine providence. He has a whole dialogue on divine providence. You can't believe it. Where God is talking to people, I'm punishing you or giving you hard things to do to make you strong and mature and all that. That's all in Seneca. Mm. And if you change the title and say St. Thomas Aquinas, ooh, they would accept it right away. Oh, the Romans had much more than we thought. People think they were stupid old, you know, like, you know, Hollywood orgy things. Well, they were not stupid orgy things.
So how does Seneca compare with the way St. Thomas Aquinas wrote Latin?
Oh, well, it's a different thing. Thomas Aquinas is school stuff, you know, kind of, you know, we would call it kind of on the spaghetti side. I mean, he was very functional. No, in school he talked that way and wrote that way just as it came out, but it would be, you know, just kind of without any kind of an idea of beauty and stuff, where Seneca has beautiful sentences, really, where he thinks of the effectiveness of Latin. Thomas was a different man and was doing something different.
St. Augustine, every day.
Oh, yeah. Although a lot of people say, and I agree, if people had kept St. Thomas, like, you know, Latin would be living today because it's very easy and functional, you see. All the classicists said, no, it's so corrupt and deteriorated and everything else. And so they threw it out in the Renaissance and put Cicero in, and Latin died. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I like St. Thomas. You have to be careful because he uses the Latin language perfectly.
It's more accessible to us.
Oh, yeah, and we were reading the other day, all the students were wild. We were reading St. Bonaventure. The sermons of St. Bonaventure at Mass, and a sermon that he gave to the nuns up in Assisi. Oh, it was so beautiful and neat and sweet. And they said, this is Frater Bonaventura's sermon to the sisters of St. Clara. So that kind of Latin is very, very exciting.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite father, Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.